get 20 blacks waiting for 20 jobs. And that's where I got in a lot of difficulty with the people that had the money. I would not do it, and I told them I wouldn't do it. And I would do it to a black, because I was fortunate that I had the support I had from my wife. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of times I started out in a block plant, lifting blocks all day long, eating cement, dust all day long. And I worked there under a foreman that, I don't know why the guy didn't want to work with us, or what type of ego trip he was on, but that was hard work. And that man was walking around watching us doing it. And we were doing the work, and we were satisfied getting it done. As long as we did it safely, it shouldn't have mattered how it done. But he wanted it done his way, and, you know, and that sort of did it to me.
Yeah.
You know, I have a way too. And if you tell me, go from A to Z, any way you get there, but at a certain time I want you at Z, when certain quality of work, then why worry about how I get there? But if you tell me I want you to go A, B, C, D, then I'll do it that way. But that has always been my experience and my dealing, not only with black ministers, yeah, but with blacks that have supervisory capacities. I might be a rebel of sorts. I'll do my job, and I'm lazy. But if I got a job to do, I'll do it. If I save me a couple of hours and you don't have some more work for me to do, figure those hours are mine, I'll do something.
Yeah.
And I think that with that type of aggressiveness, I call it, that's the way I got along with a lot of whites. I served on United Way. I paid my dues to the community. My wife had me realize something one time. I just come home bitter. The Black 400 was on my mind.
What was that?
The Black, well, you know, the ministers, the doctors, and their families, and that's what I call them, you know, the Black 400. And we weren't anywhere near that group. Not that they had the financial that would imply, the financial, you know, monies, but, you know, it were the doctors and the lawyers of the different churches and their related families and stuff, and I wasn't part of that group, you know, and I used to, that's what I used to call it.
So, is it safe to say that one of the problems with the black community land was that it was so fragmented in terms
right,
of issue?
Right.
As a youth, what were some of the major problems faced by the black community land in the area of housing, crime, and education? What were the major problems? As a youth.
Crime wasn't a problem.
Oh, it wasn't? Okay.
No, really, because just like I said, I had a school teacher that was also my Sunday school teacher. If I did something in school, and remember, back in the 30s, early 40s, there weren't too many phones in the black community.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. But we were one of the lucky ones to have one. There was a phone call to home. There was a letter taken also. And when you got home, you just got ready for whatever your family would put on you, and there was something put on you physically.
Right.
And if you walk down the street and someone on the sidewalk, or, you know, you pass and they saw you doing something, they'd either come out and straighten you out or let your mother know right quick.
So in other words, as a youth, the extended family was really operating.
That's right.
In the community, where every adult was your
with a lot of female heads of household. There were a lot of female heads of household even back from then. But it was just like, you walk down the street, someone, okay, if you did something wrong, okay, you knew you were going to get it.
Okay.
But from the educational standpoint, I think Harriet's school had some wonderful teachers. You know, we stayed in that school, and I guess we came together with whites in the sixth grade at Central Owipsey High. We had some excellent teachers. Eugene Beattie was the principal at that time and did teach some classes, and Mrs. Campbell, who later married Francois, and I almost said his name, who's now married to Warren, the barber, she was an instructor. We had excellent instruction. We were taught the things, the basic things that I still remember now at the age of 52. When I went to work at the community college, it amazed me. And I'm 41 years old or something like that, I guess, somewhere around in there, that I was dealing with young people, 18 and older, that didn't know the timetables.
Has that gotten better today? Since yesterday?
I
It hadn't improved that much in 77, 1977, the last time I worked at the college. Okay. I don't know about it today, but getting back to the educational thing, there was an incentive for blacks to learn.
In what way?
I'll tell you. Well, we had fourth and fifth grade, we had the old spelling bees. You know, you had 20 words a week, and then each Friday they'd line up on both sides of the room.
So you had teachers and community leaders that were good models.
Right.
That pushed you.
That's right. And then you had there was another incentive to get good grades was the AAA patrol boy.
Explain that.
Well, they would have a kid stand at the corner with a white belt on, and you were taught the basic safety rules about crossing the street.
Yeah.
And to get that honor to be that, you had to have an excellent grade average. I don't guess they gave us excellent, superior, or satisfactory at those times. But you had to have what I would consider now a B average to even be offered an opportunity to be a safety boy or a safety girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then, being that way, you have an opportunity to go to the opening game of Detroit Tigers every year.
Oh, everybody wants
that. That's right. But you had to have the grades first. And then Dr. Clark, Eugene Beattie, Rutherford, and all of them would throw you in the cars and take a bunch of them. Well, I was never a safety patrol, but I got good grades.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I went. So there was an incentive there. And then they were constantly telling you have to learn these basic skills if you want to go to college. Well, in 1930 and the early 40s, how many of our young black people were going to college or even had the potential of going to college? But they also encouraged us from the grammar school, Eugene Beattie and Mrs. Campbell, or Mrs. Warren, whatever her name is now, and a few of the teachers that are deceased at this time. When you go to the high school, we want you to get on a college prep course. Well, man, that was like talking Greek to us, college prep. What was this? There were only two basic courses, home economics and college prep.
Yeah.
And the blacks that came out of Perry School were all geared towards that program. We didn't know it at that time. But we began to make our selections for classes in the ninth grade. Mr. Beattie then would call us down and start giving us some information. Now, you know, when you go here, you should take this class.
Yeah.
You should take that class. And without us really knowing, they were steering us into the college prep courses that although you weren't going to college, you'd have them. Because none of the counselors, as we knew counselors back then in 44, was steering blacks into anything. Unless it was, you know, Dr. Perry's son, Dr. Clark's son, the prominent minister's son. Those people were geared and pushed without any exception. But the kids whose parents were just on welfare and ADC, give them some anything. If you're smart enough to pick it up. Well, we were lucky. We were a group of kids that went through grammar school together, and we modeled after one another. What are you taking?
In other words, particular leaders in the black community that belong to the middle class or leadership class,
yeah.
Kids were pushed. Those that were parents that were unemployed, etc., were not necessarily focused to push
that's
the
right.
direction. So you still had a certain leadership that was being pushed and
that's
and
right.
developed here. I'd like to know, ask you this question then. The children of those particular leaders, why is it that they did not, or many did not, stay in Ypsilanti but went to different cities? You know?
Well, I guess it's a growing up and wanting to getting away from your homeland, hometown, homeland, whatever. And some of the parents had monies enough to send their kids away to school. They didn't all stay here at Eastern, and some of them perhaps could or could not qualify for Michigan. But they had an opportunity to send their children away to school. And really, what is there to come back to in Ypsilanti? You know, before the 70s, and if you look at it right now, what is there to come back to?
Good question that I want to ask you then, and related to what we've been discussing. What are the major problems facing the black community of Ypsilanti today? And I'd like you to pick that up in terms of why is it that Ypsilanti has very little to offer blacks currently, like the question you just raised. What is it to come back home to?
Oh, really? Okay. You
see what I'm saying?
You
What jobs do we have here? We have factory jobs. We have some teaching jobs. And really, that was about all there was to come back to. Okay, and some of the children whose parents weren't in the middle or upper middle class, you know, my dad worked in a factory. Why should I work in a factory? Those that pursued higher education, okay, those that didn't pursue higher education, you know, it really didn't make any difference. Some of them left because of going into the military. Mm-hmm. They saw something different. They saw another part of the country that maybe they like to try their luck, basically, at, see. So now there really isn't that much industry for blacks to get into educational otherwise staying in Flint. Okay, Mr. Barfield has a company and he can't hire them all. We have several barber shops and the people aren't getting into the hairstyling that much. There's nothing really here.
But you're saying there's nothing here to stimulate the black community to strive towards something.
That's right.
There's no
from higher up, you know, professionally or educationally, what is there here? There especially is now getting a little worse because to get into the colleges, you've got to have a degree. Master's used to be a thing. Now, if you don't have a PhD,
yeah,
you're in trouble because now, because of whatever, the intelligence level, there are more PhDs now in all fields than they were 20 years ago. Because young blacks and blacks have more PhDs now than they had in the 40s.
What could you suggest as some viable alternatives for us to begin to envision or even to look at that would help perhaps enhance?
If they pooled it in some type of enterprise. I don't even know what you could do that would make any appreciable dent in the unemployment or future employment for our young blacks coming out. I really don't know. And you'd probably have to go to a higher skill of academics, you know, engineering, the type of work you're in. And then right now the market for engineers. Project, brand new, plastered, indoor toilets, hot water, hot forced air heat, you know, beautiful. And we were made to feel that, like we were something strange.
What year was this?
1943. Okay. And then when the other people around were living in houses that were poorly insulated by any standards, and, we were taught certain basic respects. Not to interfere with somebody else's property. You know, come home at a certain time. And I didn't have a father around, grandmother and mother. But now, the little children, because of TV, because of both parents or the head of household working, the TV becomes the babysitter, or the younger, older child becomes the babysitter, and they... Hey, I don't want to watch little brother. So little brother develops, or little sister develops on their own. And then as they mature, they've got this freeness with no guidelines or constraints. And it just follows them into manhood. And you've got a lot of people now with nothing to do. So let's try something. What do they try? They either try the alcohol or they try the marijuana. And they want to relate to their peer groups. And some of the peer group leaders don't want anything themselves. And a good example is this. 12 years ago. There was a young guy that had been kicked out of every school in Washington and Wayne County. His last chance was a school in Ypsilanti. He had everything, he hated everything, black and white. But he led a group of young, well-mannered, well-disciplined people to burn socks at the Board of Education building on across on Forest Avenue.
Burn what?
Their socks in protest. But now this guy had been kicked out of every known institution in Wayne, Canton,
in Washtenaw County, but yet still he was leading. He was leading these kids. And we gave our children everything we could possibly give them. We gave them freedom of thought, communication. We didn't say, okay, don't you talk to so-and-so today. And a couple kids in the neighborhood, they didn't burn dirty socks. They bought brand new socks to go down there and burn. They had a little pride about what the socks looked like, so they brought brand new socks to burn. They didn't burn some old raggedy socks. And then the teachers, we had an incident where we had a football homecoming queen contest. Well, this white teacher told all the white participants in the program, she'd already picked the winner, so they didn't have to go through this ticket buying and vote getting thing. And the blacks found out about it. And they said they wanted to tear up Old Wiltshire High. Mm. And in fact, we went down and the only way we quelled the riot, that S.L. Roberson, myself, and a few people knew collectively between us, we knew all the kids.
Wait, what was this?
Baby, when did Glenda graduate? 70.
Or 1970?
69? Yeah, 69. 69. And we collectively knew almost 150 kids, about seven of us. And they were going to turn over a police car on Cross Street Bridge down there by Frog Island, Forest Avenue, whatever it was. And we were out there at night telling, hey, you go home. We know you. We know you. Get away from those police cars. But those kids at that time, we're convinced that myself and the people my own age, that, you know, we didn't take enough action. But we tried to explain to them violence didn't solve anything. It only made you feel good for a few minutes. And the forces that you put the violence against are going to come back at you in so many ways you won't even know.
What do you think this community needs in terms of, what are some good solutions to this problem? But it's just going to sit and fester.
It's hard, but I believe that we have to get back to the type of I would call it extended parent syndrome. Like if we're here and the guy next door, he becomes the parent of the child if it's on his turf. That type of attitude and people caring again. You know, sure, you talk about the dope, you talk about people cutting people, but I still believe that there can be a group of people that can counteract a great deal of that. And it may mean you exerting a little violence on you, a little force on your part to get their attention.
What are some of the community leaders today in Atlanta, some of the black community leaders, name some, and what are they doing? Or are they doing anything at all?
I don't wish to name any, but I'll say this, that community leaders today are afraid to hurt people's feelings, and they're not saying anything. You know, that is one of my biggest problems that I had, and I'll tell you something that almost ended, well, it may have, to some degree, ended my elected political career. It was a swimming pool. Mm-hmm. It's right now at Recreation Park. Jesse Rutherford, who is now deceased, happened to be somewhere, and he was on the Huron Clinton Metropolitan Authority, mm-hmm. first black on it, representing Washtenaw County. Happened to hear us a few grants, where it's something like $350,000 for the Michigan Washtenaw County area for a swimming pool. Mm-hmm. Jesse got it for us. So I don't know if you're familiar with the area, but they wanted to put it down here in Perry School, where we built a pavilion for them after 75. And I said no. Some of the other politicians wouldn't say anything. They were listening to the people. And I said, no, I would not vote to put it down here for the simple reason it becomes an all-black pool, and it will not be taken care of. You know, the council members can moan and groan. They'll go down there and do a little something on it today, just enough to keep you from moaning and groaning, and after that. But it's now being taken care of. And I was told by members of the community and by a person who's no longer a council member that we're going to get you, Kennedy, because that pool should have been in the black community. And I told those people then why it shouldn't be in the black community. But that's the way I feel. And if I had to do it one more time,
yeah,
I'd do it again. And I tell you, I have had more problems with blacks. And the only thing I'm trying to show them is, look, let's get together, let's do it,
And I particularly don't care who gets the credit for it.
Yeah.
When I was on council, the mayor is number one person in the party and the number one person in the city. And if he gets credit for it, anybody that knows that he's got 11 people behind, 10 people behind him. So what's the difference? When your day comes for you to be number one, you'll be number one.
Why do you think many of the community leaders refuse to take a more active, more concerted stance on certain positions here? Why is it there tends to be such a degree of passivity?
I think whether it's elected or whatever, they enjoy whatever plateau they've reached by being elected or being accepted and pushed by people, and they do not wish to alienate those feelings. But I found out this, that if, and I've done it myself, if you try to be a good guy, you wind up being a bad guy. Why not tell them about it up front? This is the way it is, folks. This is the way I believe. If you can change me somewhere or other, well, that's not the way I think. What you think is an individual thought. I look at the city of Ypsilanti, anything, any commission I serve on, I look at what are the parameters of that commission, not what it is with me in the middle raised up a little bit. Okay, I serve on the water commission. I can't get 100 jobs for blacks because there aren't 100 jobs for blacks. There may be one or two jobs a year, maybe. And when I get an opportunity, I'll try to find a black, get him in line to do whatever's necessary. And we have a policy that we're trying to maintain a 10% minority count on the thing. We have another situation where if you hire a black today, you hire a white the next time, or if it's a black vacated position, you fill it with a black. We're at 10% or better right now. And that's an unwritten policy. But if I'm in the street and told some of the people who think that, you know, I'm being used, that, oh, man. So you can't tell the people how you're dealing with the structure. And at least one thing, Tony, I've learned, and I learned it well, what the structure is all about. And I didn't learn that structure from blacks. I've been, really, I should be bitter towards some of the same people I've been talking about. But I'm not, because it wastes energy. I'd like to have a couple $1 million, but maybe it's not in the card for me to have a couple $1 million. My wife and I, we have our integrity, we have our honesty, we're respected in the black and white community. A lot of people don't like what I say. They like her a lot better. She's much nicer than I am. I'm not nasty, but I just tell you, you know, I don't have the time, it won't fly. But if you would listen to me and I'll explore it with some other people, maybe we get your program to go. Well, I want the program the way I want it, no program at all. So, well, that's foolish. Some programs better than no program, and 100% of your program may not be 10% worth to the community.
Tell me, what role has the black businessmen assumed in this community? You know,
I don't really know.
I don't really know.
I know they meet.
Who are the key black businessmen in Ypsilanti?
That belong to the business professional?
No, that are just prominent. I'm talking about Ypsilanti. I'm talking about.
You can start if you want to go dollar wise. I wouldn't even say that. I'll just name them without any type of.
I just want to know the names.
You've got
owners of the black businesses in this area.
You got Lucille's Funeral Home.
What's the first name?
That's the company. I don't.
Lucille Funeral Home.
Right, and it's made up of brothers and sisters of the lady it's named after. Then you have your three barber shops, and then you have
who owns those?
J.D.
Hall.
Warren and Wiley owns one.
Warren and Wiley.
J.D. Hall owns another, and I'm losing names today. Another guy owns one. So there's three owners for three barber shops. Then there's the Barfield Industries, owned by the Barfield family. There's another small, single, Mr. Parker owns a cleaning establishment. I don't know how many people he employs.
What's his first name?
Herman Parker.
Herman Parker.
And really, that's about all I know about. There may be a couple others, but I don't know. They're either real small, or there's Bernard Morgan in construction.
Lance Forbes in construction and investments. That's about it. Of any consequence. There may be some smaller one-man operations or some guy to do contract cleaning or something like that. But those are the ones that are listed. That's okay. That pops off all the time.
Okay.
So it's very difficult. I have my ideas of how things should work. I worked on the Urban Renewal Commission. We gave a group of blacks an opportunity to own the land down there on Hamilton, Harriet, and Huron. Huron Investments, it was called. And it was back in the middle 60s, I guess. And there was some confusion there. And there was money enough there for those guys to do it. Herbert Francois was the guy's name. and J.H. Reeves and a few other, and a couple of football stars from Michigan. And they put in about, I guess, $1,500 together to make up about $20,000 of seed money. And it fell apart because a couple of guys that had the most money wanted to be the executive director, and they felt that guy should get paid. Well, what's guy going to get paid out of $25,000 seed money? Once the corporation, they could have owned the whole thing. They had stores that were going to come in. They were trying to get a Holiday Inn down there, and the government was going to loan them everything they needed. HUD was going to give them everything because HUD wanted the project to go. The Ypsilanti Urban Renewal Project was one of the worst run, well, not the worst, but they had more difficulties getting off the ground in 60, 61. So HUD really wanted to go. And they had those guys, you know, what's $1,500?
They could have gotten wealthy.
Oh, man. They could have branched out into real estate and everything else in the community that's currently being done by, you know, other people. But, you know, I'm not downing anyone, yeah. But those are my observations. Yeah. Those are the problems that I've had. And basically, a lot of the problems stem from my beliefs. I just don't believe in because blacks have been under the 200-year, 300-year gun, that this is an incentive for someone to give you something.
Yeah.
Prepare yourself. I took a course in labor relations at University of Michigan in 2 years. It was a certificate course. You had to write a paper at the end. And I went to workers' comp, law, psychology of labor, and all this stuff. Never thought I'd ever use it anymore. But I was active in the union movement, in the building trades. But in the process, I learned to deal with a lot of people, learned a lot of structure, met a lot of people. And when I applied for that job at Washington, I'd even forgotten about it in 71. I hadn't even forgotten I ever even had the thing. And then I started pulling out things. I realized the things that I had done relating to labor relations, and it was amazing. And you know, and all the blacks I've ever dealt with out of the college, I said, look, even once after you've gotten into the building trades, take at least 1 credit hour of something, or 3 credit hours of something, or one course every year, and continue to do that, because basically, when you finish your apprenticeship program, you're going to have an equivalent to a bachelor's degree, and keep adding to it. And that's what I'd always tell them. And all I ever told anybody I ever worked with, if you've learned something from me, pass it on to someone else. Yeah. Don't expect anything back from it. Because 90% of the things I've learned that helped me in a gainful employment was from whites. And I've always tried to help blacks. I can't help them the way they want me to help them. I've opened up a lot of doors and say so-and-so's coming through, and I've and don't go in there thinking that they owe you something because of the slavery days. Because that's the first thing they're going to hold against you. I said, but I can show you how to get over on these people. And what happened, you talk about reputation and stuff. I went to the Department of Labor and got certified to get the GATB test. I went to Detroit Edison and got some stuff on the Wonderlic, which I think is one of the worst things in the world. Unless you've got a PhD, you shouldn't even try to take the Wonderlic. And so I prepared myself in that way to prepare the guys I was working with. And this is all while I was working. This was nights, Saturdays, like anyone else. Like, you probably worked a lot of Saturdays and Sundays and did a lot of things for no pay to get where you're at today. And this is all I'm trying to tell these people. It's an easy thing. And once you do it, you get in the habit of doing it. You're getting a habit of trying to improve yourself. And I did all those things, and I worked with MESC. In fact, I required all the guys I worked with to take the GATB test.
Yeah, we worked out of the Ann Arbor office. And the IPSI office, you know, had some problem with it. And so we had those people coming out to Washtenaw and giving it out of Washtenaw for us. And, you know, you learn a lot of things. So what happened one time, a lot of the guys weren't passing certain sections of it. And the old rule down there was, well, look, you can't give it without giving the whole section. I said, that is stupid. And I talked to the old lady down there, the manager, and she was, I explained to her what I was doing. I said, I don't want blacks to be given something just because for 300 years. So, based on the things that we've said, these are my observations as I see 20 years of black involvement in the community. They're not always what people want, but I found out this, that in telling the truth, in dealing with the facts, they go a great deal longer, further, than telling something today to people what they want to hear. Then I don't remember what I told you. Yeah. And then when I don't remember what I told you, zap, I'm the bad guy. So on the basis of that, those are my feelings, those are my impressions, and I hope they'll be helpful in trying to make some determination.
No, I'd like to thank you for allowing me this opportunity to conduct this interview. One of the things that we do as a part of policy is that I'll have the tape transcribed and typed out, and you'll receive a copy in the mail of the interview already typed. It'll provide you with an opportunity to either make additions or deletions.
Good.
And, you know, to make further comments so that it will more reflect
all right.
The, you know, this interview that has been conducted today. Thank you.
Okay.